Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
What you just heard is the fans at the Swamp in Gainesville, Florida, home of the Florida Gators, where the fans of the Gators sing that between the third and fourth quarter of every football game. And why do we bring this up on The Athletic Support this week? It's because I Won't Back Down, that hit from Tom Petty, has become the win song of the Canadians in their own locker room. So to discuss that further, I'm Marc-Antoine Godin. I'm joined with Arpin Basu. Hello, Arpin.
Hey.
Hey.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So good too. So yeah. On Saturday night after the game in against Pittsburgh, so we got into the locker room and Tom Petty's song was blasting. So let's just. Can you share with us a little bit of what Nick Suzuki explained about it?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's basically apparently a couple of games into the season or earlier in the season than now, Cole Caulfield suggested that they take this song from the Florida Gators stadium, which they've been playing this song ever since 2017, as some of you might have read in our notebook today. you know, ever since Tom Petty died, Tom Petty being a native of Gainesville, Florida, where the Florida Gators are located, they decided they want to honor him in some way. So now they do this every game. So Cole Caulfield suggested that become sort of their song in some way. And it's you know, the words fit well with how the Canadians have been playing early on in the season. So Nick Suzuki kind of did explain that, you know, Joel Edmondson, the room DJ, has accepted this submission from Cole Caulfield and has added it to his win playlist, and they play it after they win games. So it is pretty appropriate for this group so far this season, in the sense that, you know, the Vegas game is the one that jumps out to me. The Vegas game at home, when they seemed to be out of that game, scored a couple late, you know, in the third, they came back. Made it interesting. They didn't come all the way back, but they made it interesting. And I think that's sort of the point of this team, is that they don't stop competing. And even if a bad stretch hits, they're able to regroup and have some pushback within a game. So the song, I Won't Back Down, and the lyrics especially, really seem to fit this team. And this team has embraced that identity that, you know, we're not going to win every game, but we're not going to go down without a fight, kind of thing. And so, which is a good culture to try and institute. And I think Martin Saint-Louis has been quite adamant about how much he likes that about this group, how they're very competitive, and they don't lay down. You know, they might lose the game, but they're not going to just accept that they've lost until the game's actually over. And that's Not every team has that. Hell, this team at this time last year did not have that. They'd give up one goal and the game would essentially be over. So, you know, yes, it's appropriate to this group, but when you look at it in context to a year ago, that's the most striking difference between this group and that one, is that, they don't let adversity totally floor them. They take it as a challenge and they try to rise up to meet that challenge. So the song's pretty appropriate in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It's on brand with who they are. And they've been competitive in every single game so far this season, never been blown out of the water. So I like their attitude. And it's interesting because there's a bit of a we will bend but not break type of attitude also, because when you look mm-hmm. at certain situations in a game, whether they fall behind or they just struggle to keep their lead because, you know, they'll give up a lot of chances. It's just fascinating how they manage to keep the shield up and not let the water in too much. And I don't know how long this is going to last, but when you look at for example, expected goals models, whether it's expected goals for or expected goals against, it suggests as though the Canadiens' luck might end at some point. If we can choose to consider it luck, but I mean there are situations that suggest that so far, I mean, they've been producing less chances than the other team, and it's bound to come back and bite them. Whether it's 5-on-5 or on the special teams.
Yeah. Expected goals, you know, there are a lot of metrics you can look at. There's a lot of, and Martin Saint-Louis has been pretty clear from day one, that, you know, he appreciates analytics and the Canadians have their own in-house analytics that they look at far more so, than the publicly available ones that we look at. But, you know, Martin Saint-Louis admitted, today on Monday, they does look at those expected goal models and does keep an eye on them. He doesn't obsess over them, and he has a lot of information to go through, but he's aware. Like when I started asking the question today, I hadn't even finished the question and he was already smiling. Like he knew what was coming. He knew that the Canadians, as of Monday afternoon, are 24th in the league in expected goals percentage. So that would suggest at 46%. So that would suggest that there's going to be a market correction at some point with this team.
Yeah.
And 15 games into a season, listen, the data is not perfectly clean at this point. There hasn't been enough games played, average games played, where the team plays the way it will play most nights. You haven't had enough of those games to completely weed out the exceptions, you know, to completely weed out the games like the one the Canadians just played against Pittsburgh, where they were quite dominant from start to finish. Other games where they were less dominant but won. So that's sort of those exceptional games sort of get weeded out the more a team plays games that are more typical to who they are. So Marty laughing, as the question got further and further in today, you know, told me first of all right away that he knew exactly what was coming, and he admitted that he's aware of it, but he didn't seem overly perturbed with their positioning in terms of expected goals. It's interesting to me. It's just that he's a big eye test kind of guy, and he went into it and sort of talked about how he doesn't necessarily agree with all the, you know, he'll go and break down the scoring chances and what one site or another site considered a scoring chance he didn't, which is normal because these are being generated by computers and their scoring chances are being generated by human beings who are watching the game. So it's normal that there would be a difference. Let's listen to him. He was, you know, there was a follow-up asked by our colleague Eric Engels about, if the Canadians were losing, but the expected goals model suggested they should be winning, would he pay more attention to that as opposed to what is now the opposite? Let's listen to his answer.
Let's just, for example, let's say like the data says that we lost the game by two, but I didn't feel that, you know? So I go back and look at the scoring chances themselves. And sometimes what they think is a scoring chance, I don't think it's a scoring chance, and vice versa. So is there a margin of error? Yeah, but still it doesn't mean that it lies all the time. You know what I mean? So I know sometimes, like, you know, this is pretty accurate. No, I don't really like that one, but that one's pretty accurate. And sometimes it helps you just stay honest with where your game's really at. But sometimes also, like, you got to be careful of addressing things that are not really need to be addressed. So you got to navigate with it, but it's information is power. And so we'd be you know, not smart to pay attention to it.
So, I mean, there you go. You have... You know, and I think he's right in the sense that you don't want to get overly bogged down in it. But information is power, and they would be, what he meant to say is that they would be not smart to not pay attention to it, even though he said they would be not smart to pay attention to it. I think he meant not pay attention to it.
Yeah, clearly.
And so he, you know, and this is, I think it's the right approach, you know, be aware of it, know it's there. Maybe it'll give you a hint of something that you're missing, but don't be obsessed with it.
I like the idea of staying honest with where your game is at. I think that's the whole point of it. It's because when you you know, when you choose to invest too much into statistics and just not necessarily invest too much, but if you choose only to believe what the stats tell you, you might lose a little bit of the sense or the focus of the reality of your team. But at the same time, it gives you pointers. If you completely ignore them, you might miss on some pointers that the stats will give you and say, you know what, just pay attention here. Yeah. And it's interesting also because we haven't discussed a lot about advanced stats with Martin St-Louis since he joined the Canadiens. But I've noticed that within the Atlantic Division, the coaches, the head coaches, are pretty savvy when it comes to analytics and just only expected goals. I mean, clearly, Sheldon Keefe in Toronto, I mean, he's a proponent of those. The whole brass in, with the Maple Leafs, I mean, are quite adept into those statistics. Derek Lalonde, recently named in Detroit, follows that sort of statistics. Same for Jim Montgomery in Boston, Paul Maurice in Florida. I mean, you go back to the days in Winnipeg, obviously he was, and probably even before that, he was always an astute observer and astute follower of advanced stats. And,
I mean, always bantering with our colleague, Murat Akash about, yeah, there's more than one clip of Paul Maurice making some sort of expected goals jab at Murat. And so it's, not only is he familiar with them, he actually uses them as a source of humor and mockery at times. Yeah.
And in Ottawa, DJ Smith only 10 days ago brought up expected goals, saying, you know, how the team was actually doing better statistically than the reality of their win-loss record. And he said that in time, those numbers will correlate. If you can keep those numbers up, this is usually over time, those numbers will indicate more wins. So that's why I think bringing this topic today of expected goals, I think it should serve as a reminder of where the Canadiens' game is really at, in the sense that if they start losing a few... and they don't hold on to this over 500 record, it might be because there are the seeds that have been planted since the beginning of seasons. There are telling signs that a regression is on its way.
I mean, we call them underlying numbers for a reason, because they're lying underneath the surface. You know, you could call them underlying issues. And so, but again, it's not to say that just because they have a 46% expected goals percentage, that means disaster is looming around the corner. That's not the case necessarily. Could be. And generally, as I mentioned at this stage of the season, you know, the opponents coming in, the Canadiens' next opponents, the Devils, are world beaters when it comes to expected goals. And generally in analytics, You know, their expected goals percentage as of Monday was 64%, 60% Corsi force percentage, 63% shot percentage, 62% goals percentage. I mean, they're really firing on all cylinders, and even, you know, their shooting and save percentages are not completely out of whack. You know, they come in at just under 100 actually when you combine the two. So that if you're the Devils, you can look at that and be like, okay, not only are we winning games, we're doing it quote unquote the right way. But that's not to say the Canadians feel they're doing it the wrong way. And I had a conversation with Jake Evans about this actually at practice, because if there's a guy in that room that I would think would be into this kind of thing, I would think it would have been him.
He's not though.
He's not really, like, I mean, he looks at them sometimes, but he doesn't fully buy into them. That specific metric, I should say, expected goals. You know, but he did mention one thing, because Marty has been pretty consistent on is that if the Canadians win a game but they play poorly, he's not going to be happy about it. And if they lose a game but they play well, he will be happy about it. Process over results. He's been hammering this point home all season. And so I asked Jake, I was like, so in that sense, you know, because he's like, well, we're winning games, so I don't really care, kind of thing. So I was like, okay, well, Marty says this. So can you remember a game that you won where Marty was not happy with you the next day or even after the game, but most likely the next day? And he thought about it. And he pointed to the game in Buffalo that started their last long road trip. The Canadians won that game 3-2.
There were tons of lineup changes after that.
Because Marty was not happy with the way they played.
Yeah.
And he mentioned it in St. Louis. The next stop was St. Louis. And he was like, I don't like the way we played last game. I thought we played better. He meant again, I think it was the game against Vegas. He said he thought they played better against Vegas or against Minnesota, actually, I think it was, where they lost 3-1 at home than they did in Buffalo. So I looked at that game, and just to get a sense of, like, do the expected goals correlate to Marty St. Louis' eye? And not really, because the Canadians, the expected goals numbers at 5-on-5 in that game, yes, they favored the Sabres, but it was very close. It was 50.17% to 49.83%. High danger chances, according to Natural Stat Trick, high danger chances were 12-11 for Buffalo. You know, it's shot attempts were 49-49. Like, it was an even game by these metrics, but not in Marty's eyes. He saw that game as being something that was deficient, that needed to be addressed and fixed. And I don't know if you remember, but, you know, they flew to St. Louis after the game. They practiced in St. Louis. They had a day off in St. Louis, a practice in St. Louis, a game in St. Louis, and then another practice in St. Louis. But that practice in St. Louis was an intense practice. Like, I mean, there was a lot going on there. And Marty was not necessarily all that pleased with, you know, there was a heavy agenda that practice, I guess. And there were a whole bunch of changes made and what have you. So in one sense, Marty's telling the truth when he says, even if we win a game, if I don't think we played well, I'm going to do something about it. And he's also telling the truth where he's not leaning solely on these numbers to tell him that. He didn't like that game because of what he saw. If you looked at the numbers of that game, you'd be like, they got a win. It was a one-goal game, 50-50, pretty much across the board with every metric there is here. Seems to track, seems to make sense, you know, but it's when Marty says, you know, I believe in the eye test, he's really telling the truth, because that's the one game Jake Evans identified as being one where they won the game and their coach wasn't happy afterwards.
Yeah. And I think also it depends the way that advanced stats will be handed to the coach, because generally as time advances, as years go by, should I say, teams have learned how to digest and process advanced stats and translate them into just little tidbits of information that they'll relay to the coach instead of sending him, you know, like spreadsheets full of numbers. It's basically, it might be just a one-liner or two that'll say, well, this is what the numbers say. And it's just useful information for the coach to have. He'll keep it in mind, but he's not going to start coaching based on that. So mm-hmm. I think that there's being valuing the eye test and paying attention to those metrics is not irreconcilable. What's the word for that? It's
irreconcilable.
Irreconcilable. That's it. Yes. That one thing can go with the other. Contrary to the popular public debate that it's you get one camp or the other. No, actually, you can do both. And I think that Martin Saint-Louis does that. He pays attention to that. And I think that it has become a sort of a culture within Montreal Canadiens management to be able to both pay value the eye test and the advanced stats.
Well, I mean, they wouldn't have an analytics department otherwise, right? First thing Jeff Gorton mentioned practically when he was hired is how he wanted to beef up their analytics staff. And so Chris Boucher came on and he was allowed to build a small department. And he's omnipresent around the team. And Martin often refers to the data that they have, which is largely generated by Chris, who's made a career, was a pioneer really in the world of microstats. A long time ago when I was blogging on Blogspot,
well, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, the Daily Habit, if anyone remembers that. But he was manually tracking Canadians' games publicly online and providing his microstats for free as sort of a way to show what he can do. And he went to SportLogic and he helped really shape their hockey product there. And obviously went to the Sharks and now is with the Canadians. But, you know, so the stuff the Canadians are working with, let's be clear, is far more sophisticated than what we have access to. It's far more sophisticated, with all due respect to the Twins, evolving hockey or natural stat trick or whatever. These guys are working off play-by-play sheets with, you know, a handful of data points per minute. Puck tracking technology exists. It's just not available to the public yet. Puck and jersey tracking technology, the teams do have access to that stuff. You're talking about what, hundreds, if not thousands of data points a minute. It's a different world that they're dealing with. So the data Martin Saint-Louis sees is vastly different than what we have access to, which is why I found it interesting that he still pays attention to the publicly available stuff when he doesn't really have to.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You mentioned Jeff Gorton and, you know, who hired Chris Boucher, made analytics a priority. He labeled... At first when he got the job, he said that he was open to outside the box hires. And one of the questions we got this week from one of our listeners is about Martin Saint-Louis, how he's been faring as a rookie coach, and what's, you know, and how much of a outside the box hire it really was for Jeff Gorton and Kent Hughes. So before we get any further, let's listen to this question. And please, when you leave us a voicemail in our voicemail, please identify yourself. Give us your name. But you can call us at 646-847-9404. I'll give the number again later on in the show. But here's the question.
My question is about Marty Saint-Louis. And I feel like this is kind of flying under the radar, even though there's been some coverage on it, but just how remarkable it is that he's doing what he's doing as a rookie head coach. I don't mean like a rookie NHL head coach, but like a rookie first time on the job, never done this before in my life head coach. And the kind of success he's having, it's like he's an absolute natural at this. Maybe I'm easily impressed. I don't know. I'm curious what your impression is of his the start to his very young coaching career and how he's approached it differently than other coaches in the league. And as a, I guess, an addendum to that is what this says to you about Ken Hughes and Jeff Gordon and the kind of decisions that they're going to make going forward, given that they chose this guy. It was an absolutely out-of-the-box, bold decision that seems to be working out. Anyways, look forward to hearing your answer. Thanks to both of you. Take care.
So, yeah, thanks for the question. It was a completely outside-the-box hire. We had never seen anything like it. It's funny, actually. There's a very similar situation going on in Indianapolis right now with the NFL, where the owner, Jim Irsay, hired Jeff Saturday as his head coach in the middle of a week. someone who had never coached above the high school level, Marty had never coached above the bantam level, and the Indianapolis Colts won their first game under Jeff Saturday. Who knows how that's going to work out? But yes, this is Ken Hughes and Jeff Gordon deserve some credit for this. I will say that Martin St. Louis, now that we've gotten to know him, it surprises me far less that Ken Hughes and Jeff Gordon would have been convinced that this was the right thing to do. You know, he's a different cat. Like, he is not, there's no, I'm tempted to say that other teams should learn from this. And I still do believe that they should learn from this and get out of the coaching wheel, you know? Oh, yeah. Panthers decide to fire their coach after a President's Trophy season. Let's have a look. Paul Maurice is available. Let's get Paul Maurice. Nothing against Paul Maurice. I actually love Paul Maurice. But it's so easy for teams to just look at a coach who's been somewhere, has a track record, and be like, that's the guy we need for our team because we know what he brings. Sometimes it's better to not know what a guy brings or not know what a guy brings at the NHL level. But a guy who has new ideas, a guy who's not going to do things just because other teams do it that way, or just because his own teams succeeded doing this in the past with different personnel, different circumstances, different everything. And one thing Ken Hughes has been very consistent on as general manager is he's not going to do anything just because this is how things are done. I remember asking him a question about hiring an assistant general manager. There is an assistant general manager, just for the record. His name is John Sedgwick. He has one, but many teams around the league have several, 3-4 assistant general managers who are given specific files that they handle. Canadians have one. And Ken Hughes' answer was like, well, I'm not just going to hire an assistant general manager just because other teams have them. If I see that we need something, then I'll hire an assistant general manager. I think this was an example of that kind of thinking where Ken Hughes knew Martin St. Louis very well. Jeff Gordon knew Martin St. Louis very well. Jeff Gordon had wanted to hire Martin St. Louis as a coach in the Rangers organization. So they had knowledge that the rest of us didn't, and they acted on that knowledge. That's what should be commended, is that they did not care what people thought about it. They had confidence in what they knew, and they acted on what they knew, regardless of how it would be received or what kind of impression it would give or what people would say about them. They just were confident in themselves in making that decision, and that deserves some credit, but the more we see Martin St. Louis, the more we talk to him, the less outside the box that hire seems every day.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, back in April, I wrote a story. I co-wrote a story with our colleague Joe Smith, who was based in Tampa last season. He's moved to cover the Wild this year. And we co-wrote a story, an oral history, basically, of Martin St. Louis being nicknamed Reggie Dunlop during his days in Tampa Bay, because obviously Reggie Dunlop, the name of the iconic character played by Paul Newman in Slapshot, the famous player coach for the Charlestown Chiefs, and speaking to his former teammates and coaches of the time, it doesn't surprise anybody that that he made that switch, because effectively he's been coaching throughout his playing career. That's the sort of mindset that Martin Saint-Louis had. Nigel Kirwan, the longtime Lightning video coach, said that precise thing. He says his whole career, he's been coaching in his mind. And he would, you know, he would draw plays. He would draw plays on the board during practice. He would draw plays with his fingers on the top of the board during games, you know, while he was sitting on the bench. He would be drawing plays. Uh-huh. They had this rug in the old St. Pete's Forum. They had this carpet inside their room that basically was a reproduction of a skating rink, of a hockey rink. And he would point with his stick, you know, where guys should be, explaining stuff to his teammates. And as I was doing research for photos for that article, but for a lot of the articles we wrote back in around the time that he was named head coach of the Canadiens, and I was looking for photos with him and Vincent Lecavalier together. Well, almost half of the photos you could find of those two guys together, it's Martin Saint-Louis after a whistle, before a face-off, who's actually huddling with Vinny and he's explaining him stuff. It was constant. So he always had the mindset of a coach, and the people who knew him well knew that. So I think that there's sure that people must have had cold feet knowing that he had never coached before, like officially. But if you know the person well enough, they must have known that he would be able to overcome that. And they're also open, the Montreal Canadiens, both Gorton and Hughes, they're open to the fact that even though he's still a rookie coach, even though all of his assistants are pretty much rookie coaches, I mean, I think that the one who's got the most experience right now is Alex Burrows, and he's not exactly a veteran NHL coach.
Oh, Letevsky. Letevsky has coaching experience, just not at this level.
Yeah, exactly. But I meant at the NHL level. I mean, they're all rather, it's the greenest group of NHL coaches in the league. But they're comfortable with that because they're going to let that group grow at the same time as the rest of the players. And they're okay with the coaches making some mistakes and learning along the way. But it's pretty impressive to see the level of control and comfort that Martin Saint-Louis has in this role. And also the level of credibility and confidence that he instills among his players. It's not as though, you know, he started with the Hall of Fame player who gradually loses his credibility because he shows that he's out of his depth. No. Every bit of credibility that he had because of his playing career, he's kept it, and then some, adding because of his knowledge and coaching natural ability. So it's quite fascinating to see. And it was really relevant that our listeners would point it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's worth it's easy to take for granted. So that's why another reason why I'm happy that a listener pointed it out, because you know, he looks such a like such a natural coach that it's easy to forget that this is his first full season coaching in the NHL. So yeah. Good question.
And he was asked on Monday, you know, are you going to go see Juraj Slafkovský just to make sure that he manages his body a bit better? You know, Slafkovský will be returning for suspension in tomorrow night's game against New Jersey. In all likelihood, we suppose that he's going to be inserted back into the lineup. And St. Louis said, you know, I don't feel the need to go and talk to him. And it's interesting because there's always a fine line for coaches. They want to keep a constant dialogue, especially in today's hockey, constant contact with their players, and make sure that the players knows where he stands and that the coaches, you know, that the lines of communications are really healthy. But you can tell that St. Louis doesn't want to overcrowd and micromanage and let also the player figures it out by himself. And true enough, when it comes to Slafkovský, you know, managing his strength and trying to probably better use his body from this point on, he's fully aware of what he's got to do. He doesn't need his coach to tell him. So,
yeah. No, and a funny note, you say we assume he's going to play against New Jersey. So Slafkovský had some family in from Slovakia. And they came in, you know, basically right after he got suspended. So he they didn't get to see him play. And then so when he was asked about it today, he's like, well, at least my mom was able to stick around. So hopefully I'm in tomorrow kind of thing. Like, so which is good. You don't want a rookie. You want a young player taking things for granted. I think it's a pretty safe bet that he will be in tomorrow. But yeah, about that, it's, you know, Juraj Slafkovský, Marty St. Louis, the best game that not only him, but even Canadiens management, the entire team, the game that Juraj Slafkovský played in St. Louis after that game in Buffalo that we mentioned earlier that where Marty wasn't happy with how the team played. That was universally considered Juraj Slafkovský's best game of the season to that point. And I think even now, if you were to ask them, they would probably say that was his best game of the season. Why? Not because he was blasting and blasting guys into the boards. Being physical doesn't necessarily mean that. What it does mean is engaging in puck battles, winning puck battles, initiating them, when losing the puck, getting it back right away. Those are the kinds of things he were doing. You know, Martin St. Louis referred to it as him getting on base, and that's become one of his many, many catch. One day we're going to do an episode solely breaking down Martin St. Louis' favorite catchphrases and ranking them. We're going to do that at some point. I just thought of that. But getting on base every shift is one of his things where you don't have to get a hit, just get on base. If it's a walk, even if it's an error, get the ball in play, get on base, make something happen. So Juraj Slafkovský did that game. A few days later, I think it was in Minnesota, I was able to talk to him about that and just be like, you know, when you hear your coach being really happy with the way you played physically, what kind of a message does that send to you? What do you take from that? He's like, well, the first thing I take is that I just have to finish my checks. I don't have to necessarily be this bruising forward, but when I have a chance to check someone, I have to finish it. And if I do that, and I do that consistently, and I do that for long enough, eventually it's not going to be news that I played a good physical game, because that'll just be my game. That'll be me every game. You're not going to come and ask me, you know, you played a really good physical game there. What did you learn from it? I will have already learned from it. That'll just be my game. Now you take that answer and that message, I guess, and you put that in context of what happened in Detroit with Matt Luff. You know, that was a bad hit. Everyone who saw it knew instantly, you can't do that. You can't hit a guy right in the numbers that far away from the boards and send him sprawling into the boards. It's just not good. Juraj had some explanations for it, but really just owned up to the fact that he can't do that. So it's not really a question of – that's not really a question of being physical. Like, that's not a question of his getting on base every shift. Like, the things that he was doing in St. Louis has no correlation to that hit. But having the mindset that I need to finish every check, that might have something to do with him making that hit, because he probably – Martin was asked after he was suspended if he needs to talk to him about it. And he's like, well, he didn't just start playing hockey yesterday. And one thing you learn when you're a young kid – is you don't hit a guy in the back when he's that far from the boards, at that distance from the boards. So I don't need to go tell him that. He knows that because he's been playing hockey his whole life. So I don't need to tell him that. But I just found when I saw the hit, and I'm like, that's a really bad hit, especially after Josh Anderson had done something similar, not the same, but similar a few nights earlier. I thought of that answer in Minnesota where I just have to finish every check. And I couldn't help but think, like, that's just him trying to finish that check and he just did it the wrong way kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think that your point, the difference between using your body for the purpose of keeping the puck or getting the puck versus hitting people. This is a so many people fall into the trap, and just not necessarily fans, even coaches fall into the trap of mixing the two and expecting every big player to pound the opponent. I mean, the classic example was Guillaume Latendresse, who was a skilled player who grew rapidly into a bigger frame and was drafted in the second round before he had even time to figure out how he would maneuver with this new big body that he had. And throughout his time with the Montreal Canadiens organization, they were expecting him to go out and hit people because he was big. But that's not necessarily, if it's not in your DNA, forget about it. Don't destroy your own game for the sake of hitting people. But trying to use your body to your advantage in order to steal pucks, in order to protect pucks, it's a godsend. It's a gift that you have. Seize it. Take the opportunity to use that advantage and go get those pucks. And I think that that's something that Juraj Slafkovský will learn to do better as he matures into the league. But if I compare, you mentioned Josh Anderson. Josh Anderson is a guy who uses his body to hit people on an, I would say, inconsistent basis. But when on certain nights when he's on, he presses the turbo button and he'll pin you in the board. He'll hit you like in the corner and it's going to hurt. And he's good at that when he's on his game. But when it comes to protecting the puck, when it comes to using his body just in a smart way to extend ozone shifts, he doesn't have the same effectiveness as, say, Joel Armia. So it's two, and he's also a bigger guy, but it's two different styles of physicality. And I think that Slafkovský is not going to be the one that's going to hit people all day long. And I hope to a certain extent that he doesn't become that guy. Well, and or if he does, I hope it doesn't take away anything of the finesse game that he was drafted for. And but I think that he's got such an interesting toolkit that it's only normal that he takes some time to figure it out completely. Let's not forget, he's 18 years old.
Yeah, so a few things on that. First of all, you mentioned Guillaume Latendresse, okay? This is just context to Guillaume Latendresse arriving. I watched him play when he was 14. He was allowed to play midget AAA hockey as a 14-year-old because he was so big. He was the biggest guy on the ice in the game that I saw him play, I think, twice. And he was the biggest guy on the ice on both occasions. Guys would run at him and bounce off. Like, it was like he had a force field around him. Like, basically, like, he would have the puck. He could just take the puck and go to the net and score, and no one could do anything about it. Like, it's literally like, and he was 14. He was the youngest player in the league. So it was only normal that he reached the NHL. Like, he never learned how to properly play physical because he didn't have to. He grew up in this environment where guys, I would imagine, after a while, just stopped even bothering trying to hit him because it served no purpose, you know? So then all of a sudden you find yourself in the NHL and guys are hitting you and you are going down and you are not the biggest guy on the ice anymore. That's a tough adjustment to make, you know? I mean, or even in the queue, I think even in the queue, he never really had to worry about being physically weaker than someone, you know? And so that's a difficult adjustment. That's one thing. When you were talking about, you know, don't let your frame change the way you play, but take advantage of it, I instantly think of Kirby Doc. You know, Kirby Doc.
Yes.
One advantage of his frame is his use of his reach. He's incredibly good and has an incredibly high level of understanding of how and when to use his reach. He does it offensively with the puck. He does it defensively more often without the puck. But one thing he doesn't generally do is pound guys on the forecheck. If you look, you know, I looked at a ton of his shifts in Chicago last year, and it was, there were some instances that were just flat out embarrassing where no matter if you're a physical player or not, if you're in on the forecheck on a guy, you have to run him into the boards. Whether you kill him or not is up to you, but you need to if a player is eligible to be hit and has the puck and gets rid of it just as you arrive, you got to do something. You got to disrupt him in some way. And Doc just didn't do that. Now, I think we're seeing a bit more of that from him this season. I think he realizes to some extent maybe that he wasn't doing that. But that doesn't – just because he wasn't doing that didn't mean he was not using his physical gifts. Him using his reach is one way to use your physical gifts without being a bruiser. So when you mentioned the finesse side of Juraj Slafkovský's game, I was talking to him today, and we got to talking about his time in Finland and his ice time and how he started the season. He was like, you know, first five games, I was getting like 18 minutes a night. Everything was great. And then all of a sudden it went down to 10 or 12. And then I went to the Olympics and I came back from the Olympics and it was back up to 16 and I was on the second power play. And so I was curious to hear, like, well, where did you play on the power play? Like, well, they moved me around, but basically I was net front. And then I was like, well, do you like playing net front? Because I think it's easy to look at you and say, oh, well, you'd be a great net front guy. You're so big, big guy. Yeah. Like, but do you actually like it? He just kind of looked at me and was like, no, not really. I don't like it. you know, it's not his thing. And at one point he said, so we got to talking back and forth. He prefers playing on the right flank in the right circle so he can shoot the one timer and what have you. But what was so great is, so we're talking and he just says, he's like, I understand that I'm a big guy, but I know how to use these too. And he took his two hands and he put them up and he looked at them. And he was like, but I know how to use these too. And he stopped looking at me and looked at his hands. Like he had like a moment with his hands. And was just kind of like, you know.
Big hands.
Yes. Like, yes, I'm a big guy, but this is, my tools of my trade are these two things.
Yeah.
It's not my ass and it's not this and it's not that. My hands are what make me good. And that's important to maintain, and that's important to cultivate and to nurture, is to make sure that he understands that he's physically gifted and that gives him an advantage and how to take advantage of that gift, but also understand that the organization appreciates the fact that he has those hands, and that's why they drafted him, and that's what's going to bring him a lot of success, is the combination of the two. But never in any circumstance should anyone ask him to forego or make one more important than the other, make the physical part more important than the hands part, because you could tell his pride comes from his hands. It doesn't come from the fact that he's a gifted physical athlete. His talent and his skill is what gives him pride and makes him the hockey player that he is, and that needs to be maintained at all costs.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're gonna tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
In terms of scouting also, the fact that the Canadians were so comfortable drafting him, of course, the size was appealing, but the fact that he played against men and showcased his ability, his skill level against men, was more significant than if he had been at the junior level, because as you pointed out when you referred to La Tendresse earlier, bigger guys tend to have this natural advantage that they don't have to work as hard, and they're to dominate just because they have a natural physical domination at an earlier age. Whereas Slafkovský playing against men back in Finland, he did not have that advantage. He was still one of the bigger guys, but it was not such a big clash as if he had played, let's say, in the OHL. So mm-hmm. And I think that it's a gift in itself. It's a chance that he had, that basically he was able to showcase himself while playing against men rather than having to convince, you know, scouts that his success was partly because of the fact that he was so much bigger than everybody else. So, and because I think that this is a lesson that the scouts have learned over time, and they a trap that they want to avoid, saying, okay, so as tantalizing it can be to watch a prospect who's so physically gifted, we have to remember the fact that the edge that he's got now, he's going to lose it at the pro level. And once he loses that edge, what's going to be his new default? What's going to be his fallback production level, basically, once we take that natural edge off his game? So, but I think in that sense, Slafkovský was benefited from playing in Finland in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it might be the only benefit, but still.
Yeah, he was not. He was not overly happy with his with his stint in Finland, I think.
Yeah,
and the Canadians
he played. He was on a championship level team, but it was not a team that had his. It was not a team that was invested in his development as a hockey player. That's for sure. Let's just call it that. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, we do have one more voicemail that we wanted to get to this week, so we're going to close the show with that because it's not a delicate question to answer, but I think it's important to do so. So let's listen to that question now.
Hi, Arpin. Hi, Marc-Antoine. This is David Martin in Quinton, Massachusetts. I just wanted to call and ask, given the recent controversy around the Miller signing in Boston, what do you think are the parallels and divergences from the signing of Logan Mailloux? Obviously, the nature of what both did is very different. And with Mailloux, it was one incident as opposed to Miller being years of abuse. The reason I bring this up is because the NHL released that Mailloux has not been cleared to play at league level. So do you think that this is still, as of this moment, warranted, or do you think that this is only coming about because of the issue that happened with Miller? Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Okay, thanks for the question, David. And yes, I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, there are some similarities to be drawn between the two situations. None of the similarities have anything to do with Mitchell Miller or Logan Mailloux, in my opinion. The similarity lies in how two NHL organizations behaved in the face of a certain set of information that they had to work with, and how it came in conflict with their natural instinct to find the best hockey players imaginable and to improve their team in any way they can. First off, I think it should be said that it's really unfortunate that Logan Mailloux is being drawn into this conversation with Mitchell, in this comparison with Mitchell Miller, because of the similarities between how the Canadians and the Bruins behaved. You know, Logan Mailloux, like when the Bruins talked about Mitchell Miller making a mistake and the Canadians talked about Logan Mailloux making a mistake, I'm far more willing to buy that Logan Mailloux made a mistake because it was a singular incident that he owned up to, as opposed to Mitchell Miller making a mistake that lasted 4 years. Was a pattern, like a total pattern of behavior, despicable behavior for a very long time. So that right away differentiates between the two. And I think the main thing that differentiates the two of them is that Logan Mailloux was proactive in trying to own up for what he did. And whereas Mitchell Miller has never given any real genuine, sincere indication that he's learned a thing from what happened. And frankly, you listen to sort of some of it, and it's hard not to get the impression that Mitchell Miller feels he's the victim in this whole thing. I don't think Logan Mailloux ever really behaved that way. So that's that. But to answer, you know, the similarity really does lie with how the Canadians and the Bruins evaluated each of these things. Another thing I would say about Logan Mailloux, sorry, is that, you know, I've talked to a few people in the Canadiens organization, and he's working. He's already looking at like nonprofits in the Montreal area that he could one day work with should he ever come to the Canadiens and try and educate young people about the perils of cyber violence and sexual crimes online and things like that. And he wants to use his story. He said this, but he does, according to a few people in the organization, this is already something that's in the works. His French is getting polished. He's trying to make preparations to come to Montreal and not only play hockey, but also try and make a difference in the community. Whether he's able to do that is unclear, and I can't say firsthand that I know what kind of work, but I know that the Canadians were not willing to commit to that guy until he showed the work, and that they have been not only satisfied, but exceptionally impressed with the amount of work that he's done. So that's that. As for Gary Bettman saying that Logan Mailloux's not eligible to play in the NHL, this is actually not the first time he said this. He made it clear as soon as the Canadiens drafted Logan Mailloux that he would be subject to review by the NHL before he was deemed eligible to play in the NHL. So this was years ago. He just reiterated it recently because he was asked, again, in the wake of the Mitchell Miller signing by the Bruins, and when he said that Mitchell Miller was not eligible to play in the NHL until they reviewed his case and deemed him to be. So the only reason Logan Mailloux is ineligible to play in the NHL is that the NHL has not reviewed his case, because the Canadians have not set that wheel in motion, because they have no intention of having Logan Mailloux play in the NHL anytime soon, frankly. I mean, maybe next year, but it's highly doubtful it would be next year. So maybe 2 years from now, he might be ready to play in the NHL. At that point, they would have to approach the commissioner's office and say, okay, well, we would like to bring this player into the NHL. Can you please review his case? At which time he will do that. So the fact that Gary Bettman said that Logan Mailloux is not eligible to play is him just being consistent with what he said in the past. And it's also just him saying that I have not been asked to change my stance on it. Once the Canadiens do that, and they did consult the league before signing Logan Mailloux to a contract, but once they're ready to have him play in the NHL, that is when the commissioner's office will be asked to make a judgment on this player and whether or not he is able to or not able to play in the NHL. But I would say that from the Canadiens' point of view, and not from my own personal point of view, but from the Canadiens' point of view, what they've seen from this young man, you know, was enough for them to sign him. And that was a way bigger endorsement than it would be for, say, when they signed Owen Beck or when they signed Philip Meschar. This was an endorsement of everything Logan Mailloux had done to try and win their trust. And he had won it enough to sign a contract. So now the next step will be for him to prove to the commissioner's office that he should be allowed to play in the NHL when the Canadians consider it an appropriate time to do so.
Yeah. The information I got, though, is that Gary Bettman was not too happy when the Canadians chose to sign Logan Mailloux. I don't know if it's just because he was expecting to be giving his authorization beforehand or whatnot, but I think that he was a bit surprised and not too happy about it. I think it was nothing that will keep the Canadians in his bad books, though. I think he was far more upset the day that the Canadians chose to draft him. And I think that goes into also the parallels between the two situations, the Mailloux and Mitchell situations, because you're right, Arpin, it's two teams that were basically taking shortcuts to add a talent at a bargain. But Miller caused a precedent some sort in, when he was drafted in 2020. And the uproar following his draft, it really put a spotlight on the NHL and put the league in the position where I think they started thinking, well, we have enough issues as it is. We certainly don't want to have our players being talked about for the wrong reasons. So do we really need to draft further headaches? So when the Canadians go ahead and draft Mailloux the year after, well, it's really along the same line. So I think that's mainly the similarity that we can...
Well, look at both cases. Draw. In both cases, the Canadians, what were they short of in their pipeline? Right shot defenseman.
Yeah.
They go outside. What are the Bruins short of in their pipeline? Everything. So they need talent flat out, yeah. And there's guys just sitting there available. And what was the other similarity in both cases? In both cases, each team was convinced another team was going to get this guy, so they had to act quickly. And so the Canadians, Trevor Timmins said it, Marc Bergevin said it. If they didn't draft him, he was going to be drafted in the second round. To which I would say, go ahead, let them draft him in the second round. You don't have to draft him. But they felt he was far higher on their list than he was at 31. So they would draft him because they were going to be that team. The Bruins were under the impression, at the very least, that there was competition for Mitchell Miller's services, to the point where Miller's agent, Eustace King, said on this the Cam and Strick podcast that, you know, sort of the end of their meeting with the Bruins was like, oh, I hope you choose us, as if there were all these other teams.
He had many suitors, yeah.
Yeah. So that says a lot, A, about the Bruins, the circumstances surrounding the Bruins' decision to sign him, where some of their own due diligence took a back seat to the competitive nature of the NHL. Because if they had taken the time to speak to the victim's family, to speak to the victim himself, who released a statement completely contradicting everything Mitchell Miller's agent said on that podcast, you know, you can go listen to it for yourself, but it was quite a performance on that podcast. But anyhow,
But it doesn't just say something about the Bruins. It says also, if it's true that there were many suitors.
Well, that's my point.
It says something about, yeah.
It's not only the Canadians that were going to draft Logan Mailloux. At least the Canadians thought that. And I'm sure a team would have at some point drafted him. And the Bruins, the same thing. Like, if it weren't the Bruins, it was someone else. So it's not limited to these two teams. It's we don't know how many teams were in on Mitchell Miller. And no team's obviously going to admit it at this point. So we'll never know. The only person who probably knows is Eustace King, his agent. But it does show sort of a wider cultural issue in the NHL where character and moral clauses take a back seat to the competitive nature of the business on two separate occasions. And the fact... Everything that happened with the Canadians after drafting Logan Mailloux served as no lesson at all to the Bruins and any other team that was talking to Mitch Miller at all. So 2 years pass, and it's like nothing changed. We didn't learn a thing from that. We didn't learn a thing from what happened to the Canadians. We didn't learn a thing from Jeff Molson having to publicly apologize, make this whole action plan, put in place his task force, eventually completely fire his front office, which was, I'm convinced, the wheels were put in motion for that on draft day. Everything that came as a fallout for the Canadians in this situation, somehow the Bruins saw that happening and learned nothing from it, like zero. And neither did the other teams that were interested in Mitchell Miller, if there were any. So it's mind-boggling how long it takes for lessons in this league to be learned. And who knows if they ever will be learned. We're going to have another case like this, and it might not go any differently.
Well, we hear a lot about, you know, you have to believe in second chances. Well, second chances are earned. And I think that the Canadians, when they made the choice to not part ways with Mailloux and just invest in him, they helped him to set the course for that second chance. The second chance is not not renouncing to their pick or forfeiting their pick. It was basically say, well, we're not going to sign you right away, and you're going to do the work. And to his credit, Logan Mailloux has put in the work. And the second chance is finally signing this contract more than a year after, because he's shown enough to the Canadians to say, well, I'm worth keeping around, and you can trust me. And I think that this, from that point on, if the guy does the work honestly and he's truthful about it, sure, you give a second chance. And that's where we're at with Logan Mailloux.
I've spoken to enough people in the Canadiens organization about him to safely say that he has earned the trust of that organization at this point with the work that he's put in and the sincerity of the work that he's put in.
I think sincerity is a big big word here.
It certainly is in reference to the other guy that we're talking about here.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody. Well, thank you so much for listening to the Athletic Support again this week. Once again, if you want to leave us a message on our voicemail, you can do that at any time. You just have to dial the 646-847-9404. That's 646-847-9404. We'll be back with Le Super Athletic on Friday. And until then, well, enjoy your week. I'm really looking forward to the Devils coming in town. I don't know if you guys have been able to see that, but after the fans in New Jersey chanting Fire Lindy after the third game of the season in New Jersey asking for head coach Lindy Ruff to be fired, the same fans chanted Sorry, Lindy, the other night, because they recognized that their head coach is actually doing a pretty good job.
And Lindy accepted the apology and said, one day we can all have beers about it together. So it's a great story, but the Devils are a legitimate, fascinating team right now. And so should be a good show on Tuesday. And, after a visit to Columbus by the Canadiens, not us, we'll be back on Friday with the Spog at the Tickets, Mark Caton mentioned. So have a good week, everyone.
Bye-bye.